Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Okay, so we're going to finish a little early today. I have to go into the city. So we'll continue on where we left off yesterday. Prabhupada was explaining that in the beginning you have to be very expert and active. Yeah, and you gain the qualification for chanting by preaching work. By working very hard in Krishna consciousness, then gradually you get purified to the point where you can actually chant Hare Krishna 24 hours a day. So again, on that same thing, that theme then, August the 8th, 1976, Prabhupada was in Vrindavan. It was just getting towards the end of the second leg of the Gopurnima festival. In those days, everybody would go to Mayapur, spend a week or two, and then everybody would cross over the country and spend another 10 days or so in Vrindavan. Nowadays, the Vrindavan leg of the festival is not so big, but people prefer to go to Vrindavan during Karatik. But anyway, that was Prabhupada's plan, have everybody go to Mayapur and Vrindavan at Gopurnima time. So he was explaining in his class that this was on April the 8th, what is required of us if we wish to please Krishna and get his blessings. We have to surrender, Prabhupada said. That will please Krishna. And without pleasing him, then you cannot see Krishna. You may have your eyes, big eyes, but you cannot see Krishna. You have to please him, and that pleasing activity is bhakti. Without that bhakti, it means sitting down silently. Oh, no, I am chanting. I do not want to go out. I am busy. So this means an excuse. What will you chant? You'll simply think of money and women. That's all. You just work. You go and sell books, and you work hard. That is wanted. Therefore, we do not give that opportunity. My Guru Maharaj did not give this opportunity, and we are following the same principle. No opportunity of sitting idle. No, you must work, and that will rectify. So that was a point Prabhupada often made, that so-called meditation, if the mind is not actually purified, then just simply sitting down silently, making a show of chanting or meditating, but the mind will automatically be thinking of sense enjoyment, that's all. Either the men will be thinking of women, the women will be thinking of men, and money, material security, you know, how to be comfortable in the material world, etc., etc. So that opportunity, Prabhupada was saying, is not being given in his ISKCON movement. As he says, they go and sell books and work hard. This lecture was, of course, given mainly to a group of devotees that were Sankirtan devotees. Most of the devotees that would come over for the festival in those days were Sankirtan devotees. So Prabhupada knew, you know, in a few days' time they would be returning to the temples. So he was encouraging them, go and sell books and work hard. And that will rectify that materialistic mentality. Okay, so we've said a little bit about chanting 16 rounds. And I mentioned yesterday a couple of instances of what happens when one does not, when one tries to chant more than one is capable of. Sharmadas was doing 150 rounds. Odalami Das Babaji lasted about less than 6 months So one has to be realistic and do what we can comfortably do or honestly do. And therefore, Prabhupada gave us a whole variety of, you know, different engagements so that our restless minds can be constantly occupied and satisfied. So, of course, there are sometimes, Prabhupada, you know, did say that not less than 16 rounds, and there was a standard in Prabhupada's time, I don't know whether they still do it nowadays, where on a codices, everybody would chant 25 rounds, because a codice is meant for extra chanting and fasting. And there were a couple of occasions when Prabhupada was questioned about that standard. The first one, one reference was on July 5th, 1975, when Prabhupada was in Chicago. It was on a morning walk. Tamal Krishna Goswami was there. And he brought that topic up about 25 rounds on the codicil. So he said, "I remember that you were instructing once that all of your initiated disciples should chant 25 rounds." Prabhupada said, "Minimum." And Tamal Krishna said, "Minimum on this day." "So is that a rule that we should all follow in our temples?" The Prabhupada said, "We are 16 rounds." And Tamal Krishna said, "No, I mean on a codicil." So Prabhupada said, "Yes, a codicil, simply you should chant. No other business. Nirjal." Tamal Krishna asked, "No preaching work? Should they go out for preaching?" And then Prabhupada clarified, "No, for those who are preaching, this is not for them. For those who are sitting idle, they can chant more." They have no other regulation. For the others, there is no other regulation, simply preaching. A preacher is so exalted, so he hasn't got to follow any regulation. But don't take that as an excuse. But actually, if one is busy in preaching work, that is first class. So this is not my manufactured word, but my Guru Maharaj. So there was one devotee, that Madhava Maharaj, when he was a brahmachari, his name was Hayagriva. So he was to go somewhere, but he was sick. So Guru Maharaj informed that he was sick and that today is a codicil, so he cannot take his regular meals. So Guru Maharaj said, "No, let him immediately take his meals and go." So that was a famous incident where this Hayagriva, you know, he had some special work to do on it, he could do it. And so Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati said, "It doesn't matter about a codicil, give him the meals so that he gets some strength and he can do his service." That's not to say that we can use that as an excuse and, you know, claim I have some special service to do and avoid the regular fasting. But under some circumstances, under all circumstances, preaching is always superior to any other activity in Krishna consciousness. So that was on July 5th, 1975. And in February of 1976, Tamal Krishna Maharaj was again on a morning walk with Srila Prabhupada, this time in Mayapur, and the exact same conversation came up again. So Tamal Krishna asked, this was February the 11th, about chanting while observing a codicil. "We should always chant 25 rounds on a codicil if initiated," he asked. It was an exact replay of the same conversation. Prabhupada said, "Initiated? Everyone. Why initiated?" So Tamal Krishna asked, "So that should be the standard for our movement on a codicil day?" Prabhupada said, "Standard is 16. But if he can chant more, then he is welcome." So Tamal Krishna pressed to know if 25 was mandatory or not. When Jayapataka Maharaj suggested that it was recommended, Prabhupada seemed to disagree. "No, a codicil means that, fasting and chanting." However, when Tamal Krishna Maharaj referred to his men going out in book distribution, Prabhupada was quick to clarify, No, that is also preaching work. For that purpose, you can stop this. But generally, one who has no preaching work, he can chant extra." It was an exact replay of the same conversation. So, and another instance where Prabhupada recommended some devotees should chant more than the regular 16 rounds. This was December the 3rd, 1975. I had just been added to Srila Prabhupada's party as his full-time servant the day before. And there was a sannyas initiation held on the 3rd of December. As his Indian, Canadian and French disciples sat before him, Prabhupada conducted the fire jagat this morning for sannyas initiations of Lokanath, Sridhar and Prituputra in the temple courtyard. He gave a short talk based on the sannyas mantra beginning Etam Sastaya Paratma Nishtam from the Chaitanya Charitamrita. He told them that although they are young men in the face of the very powerful material energy, if they simply keep full faith in Krishna and follow the previous acharyas, then they'll remain fixed up. He advised them to do this by chanting the Hare Krishna mantra, and he even suggested that as sannyasis they should chant extra rounds. Describing the sannyas initiation as the last ceremonial procedure in the Varnashram system, and the sannyasi as the guru of the other social and spiritual divisions, he told them to follow the example of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and preach all over the world. So, okay. So, as Prabhupada said, if you just simply sit down and try and chant, then the mind will go to, you know, all those material things. And similarly, one time I got caught out sitting and sleeping when I was with Prabhupada in Bombay in the old days, when Prabhupada got Juhu Beach property. There were six apartment blocks on that building, on that plot of land. There were two stories each, and they were all occupied by tenants. So one of the first things that Prabhupada did was build an extra floor on the top of all of those buildings so that they would have some space for his disciples and offices, etc. So one of the buildings, the top floor, was reserved for Srila Prabhupada and his secretaries. So there were two flats, one on either side of the stairwell. One flat was for Prabhupada and we were all staying in the other side. So in the night time, of course, we would leave there, go and sleep. Prabhupada would be up working, translating his books. And then about 5 o'clock in the morning, then I'd go back inside Prabhupada's rooms. If he was still in his sitting room, then I would wait in the front entrance room. So when you went in, there was a small room, like a reception room. And in that, there was a toilet, which was, of course, you know, sectioned off. But on the side of the toilet, there was a sink where Prabhupada would, you know, brush his teeth in the morning. So that was open in the room there. So I would go in, I would sit on the floor and start chanting. And, you know, and wait for Prabhupada to come out of his workroom, and you know, then we would get ready for the morning walk. So this particular morning, December the 19th, this morning at about 5 o'clock, I was sitting on the bare floor of the front reception room trying to chant my japa. Prabhupada came out to brush his teeth in the sink, but I failed to notice him because I was nodding asleep as I chanted. Prabhupada wasn't angry, but he told me, "Do not sit while you are chanting. Sitting means sleeping." So, you could put that on a bumper sticker. Yeah, sitting means sleeping. Being Prabhupada's servant, I sometimes find it difficult to chant good rounds because I'm expected to remain on call in the room adjacent to his throughout the day. I've had to learn to chant almost silently so as not to disturb him, and this makes it harder to be attentive. Previous secretaries and servants have also had trouble chanting properly due to the demands of the engagement. So that was one lesson that I learned. Don't sit and chant. Of course, we all know that. Well, I remember when I first joined in the Sydney Temple in 1972 in Glebe, Ajameel Prabhu was the temple commander. And after Mangalarati, we would all sit on the you know, around the wall and start chanting. And invariably everybody, you know, people would start chanting and they, you know, be out. Arjuna was the temple commander, so he would walk around. And as he walked around, if he saw anybody nodding out, he would whack them on the heads with his beads just to wake them up again. So we all know that, you know, sitting means sleeping business. There was one time, though, when I managed by chanting to stay awake. One of my duties, of course, my last duty of the day as Prabhupada's servant was massaging him. That was usually from about 10 o'clock to 11 o'clock. When I first took up the service, the first day that I was shown how to do that service by Upendra Prabhu in Delhi, it was a very short, you know, 10-minute thing. Prabhupada had gone into his bedroom. Upendra signaled for me to follow in. And Prabhupada lay on the bed, fully clothed. It was because the midday massage was with oil. But the evening massage was just Prabhupada's legs and feet. You know, his hips, thighs, calves and feet. And Prabhupada would lay on the bed. If the bed was big enough, you would sit up on the bed with Prabhupada at his side and then massage his legs. If the bed was like a single bed, then you had to stand. So that made it a little bit more difficult. But at least while she was standing, you couldn't go to sleep. If you were sitting, that was another story. And especially because at night time, you know, you'd had a full day's service. And Prabhupada would take rest about, you know, 9:30, 10 o'clock. The lights would go out. All the other devotees, you know, would have already taken rest. And so you'd be there basically on your own. Well, because Prabhupada was there, but Prabhupada would often, you know, he would close his eyes and he would rest. So sometimes he would also snooze or, you know, fall asleep. And then, you know, you had to keep on going. Upendra told me the first time he did that service, he saw Prabhupada fall asleep. So then he thought, oh, okay, now Prabhupada's asleep, I can stop. So then he started heading out the room. And just as he got to the door, then he heard Prabhupada's voice in the darkness. Oh, you were finished? So then he had to come back. So he said, he told me, you have to keep on going until Prabhupada tells you to stop. So the first night, after 10 minutes, Prabhupada just gave a little hmm. And that was it. Then that was the signal we could stop and go out. But then gradually, it was getting longer and longer. And by the time we got to Mayapur, January, then February, and then by March, that was actually becoming, you know, a 1.5 hour or 2 hour marathon. And it was becoming the most, what I thought originally was the easiest part of the service became the most difficult. So this was on March the 1st. Evening massage is also becoming difficult to perform. It's been getting increasingly longer each night. Every evening after the pujaris fumigate Prabhupada's bedroom with incense to drive out the mosquitoes, Anakadundabi Das and myself drape a large net around his bed. When Prabhupada lies down to take rest at about 10 p.m., the lights go out. I slip under the net and perch cross-legged at his side to massage up and down his legs and feet as he softly slumbers. Previously, the massage lasted between a half hour and 45 minutes. But here in Mayapur, the sessions have been going on for an hour or even longer. Tonight, it went on for over 2 hours, the longest ever. I left Prabhupada's room just after midnight. I find it very difficult to sit in the dark, sweating under the mosquito net, breathing air thick with incense smoke, with no breeze for relief, and not a sound save Srila Prabhupada's soft snoring. It is difficult to stay awake on the job. Occasionally, I do drift out, only to snap suddenly back to consciousness without knowing how long I'd been out. So that was, you know, you'd start massaging and then start getting the nods. And And then you suddenly, you know, and keep on going. And you wouldn't know whether you'd been out for 5 seconds or 5 minutes or 15 minutes, you know, but you just have to keep on going. So I was really struggling with it, you know, how to stay awake while I'm doing my service. So tonight, by Krishna's grace, I was able to stay awake by chanting shlokas within my mind. I remembered that in the Gita, Krishna had called Arjuna Gudakesh, the conqueror of sleep. So my little experience is giving me a glimpse of what a high degree of sense control is required to earn that title of Gudakesh. So I just, you know, in those days I knew quite a few slokas, maybe about 150 or 200 slokas. So I just started chanting every sloka that I could think of. And by doing that, I actually managed to stay awake for the whole 2 hours. So, but it was actually the only night that I was able to do that. But anyway, it was a little pleasing experience. Okay, so some other aspects of chanting. As a principle of good management, of course, Prabhupada always stressed that his managers have to be spiritually strong. We're not a material, you know, movement or an ordinary mundane religious movement. We depend on our purity as the force for, you know, doing all our activities in Krishna consciousness. So this was on January 7th, 1976. Prabhupada was in Nellore. Nellore is in South India. It's about 3 hours north of Madras. On January the 1st, we'd flown down there. Prabhupada did 2 days, Pandals in Madras. Then on the 3rd, we went up to Nellore. There was supposed to be some land that was being given to ISKCON to build a temple on by two sisters. We stayed there at their place for about 5 or 6 days. At the end of the visit, it turned out that they were trying to cheat us. And although Prabhupada had laid the foundation stone, put the Anantashesha in and unveiled the plaque, afterwards, when the sisters refused to change certain conditions that had been written into the deed of gift, Prabhupada told the devotees to dig up the Anantashesha and remove the foundation stone, and we left that place. But at this point, anyway, we were staying in the house, and Prabhupada was continuing to receive his mail from all over the world. So he received one from Madhavisa Swami. At that time, he was the GBC here in the South Seas. And some developments were going on in Fiji. The Punja brothers there, they had decided to build a temple for ISKCON. Madhavisa, he was the GBC for that region. So he wrote from Fiji, explaining some managerial problems confronting him. The society in Fiji is being organized mainly by Mr. Deoji Punja and his family, and gradually others are becoming involved. In legally registering ISKCON, Madhavisa wants to make sure that all of the trustees are conforming to Srila Prabhupada's standards, following the regulative principles and chanting 16 rounds daily. Mr. Punja is adhering to the principles, but one or two of the other trustees are not, although they are very favorable and have given large donations. So he requested Srila Prabhupada to ask them personally to stand down in favor of Deoji's brother, Karshanji. Prabhupada knows it is a sensitive issue. The impetus for the establishment of ISKCON Fiji arose originally from Deoji and his brother's enthusiasm to invite Srila Prabhupada to come there. Prabhupada doesn't want to act in such a way that it might strike people as being arbitrary. Thus he advised Madhavisa to arrange everything locally with a consensus of agreement. He said, if any of the trustees are to be dropped, this should be discussed amongst the trustees themselves. These are all important men, and we should be very careful lest they become offended. If I say something, it will not look well. If some of the trustees are not abiding by the principles or not chanting 16 rounds, then they should be induced by the other trustees who are following to step down. I think you can follow what I mean. So that was done. And Daoji's brother, Karshanji, was added because he was actually following all the standards. So not long after that, a week later, Madhavisa actually came from the South Seas to join up with Prabhupada's party for a few weeks. On the 17th of January, we traveled to Mayapur. And then on the 18th, then we had a little meeting. Actually, in those days, Mayapur was very quiet. Just at the weekends, people would come. But during the weekdays, nobody would come. So Prabhupada would have some quiet time, especially in the afternoons. So it was nice just to go and sit in his room with him. Madhavisa was there, so he took advantage of the opportunity to get some, you know, close personal association with Prabhupada. And so on the afternoon of the 18th, Madhavisa asked a few managerial questions regarding ISKCON Fiji. Daoji Punja, who was instrumental in establishing ISKCON there, is chanting the Maha Mantra and following the regulative principles. He is channeling money from his supermarket and other shops into building a Krishna temple, but meanwhile, he is still selling meat and liquor in the stores. So it was a supermarket, and they had the biggest supermarket on the island. They're one of the wealthiest families on the island of Fiji. And because that business was owned by Daoji and his brothers, there were several brothers, and very typically, you know, Indian families, they like to keep the business amongst the family members, and it's usually, you know, quite a tight bond. So this was a problem, it was a dilemma. And Madhavisa expressed uncertainty whether to tell him to cease such sales or not. So he wasn't sure, should I tell him or not tell him? You know, after all, it was an established business. He's doing so much service, he is following the principles himself. So what to do? So Prabhupada said that he should be allowed to continue and not be forced to give it up. He quoted the Bhagavad Gita 18:48, every endeavor is covered by some sort of fault, just as fire is covered by smoke. Therefore, one should not give up the work which is born of his nature, O son of Kunti, even if such work is full of fault. So Prabhupada expressed confidence that if he is chanting Hare Krishna, these things will soon be properly adjusted. And in fact, that's what happened. Prabhupada went there a couple of months later at the end of April, and by that time, Daoji on his own had come to the conclusion that it was intolerable to sell meat and liquor anymore and make money from that. So he decided to actually leave the family business. So they broke it up. He was given his share, and then I think he opened a prasadam restaurant and some ice cream parlors. Yeah. So, you know, just automatically by chanting, Prabhupada had that confidence. He'll come to the right point eventually. He must do if he's doing it seriously. And he did. So sometimes when you're a manager, you have to be very patient. If you see that somebody's not, you know, doing things properly, but is sincerely trying, then you have to give them time. You have to give them a bit of space, encourage them, and then gradually, they'll come to the right platform. But not, you know, immediately have to get on their case and, you know, make it a do or die, you know, situation. So similarly, another devotee, Yasamani Nandan, he was just beginning, not our Australian one, but the Indian one, he was just beginning some preaching work in Ahmedabad on the last week of December. He went up to Ahmedabad with Srila Prabhupada. We had some programs in a city called Sanand, small town actually, just outside of Ahmedabad. And on the last day that we were there, Yaso had brought Srila Prabhupada to see a couple of places that he was thinking of renting. So they were just starting ISKCON's activities there at that time. Prabhupada saw one place, he liked it, so he told him to go ahead and get it. So 10 days later, when he was in Bombay, he got a letter from Yasamani Nandan, who sent an update on his attempts to secure a suitable centre in Ahmedabad. The building he had taken Srila Prabhupada to see had several defects, and since then he has located a much better place in the city centre, but it is only available initially for a 3-month period. He said the owners are thinking of using it for some charitable cause, so Prabhupada encouraged him to accept it despite the time limit. He said, even if you can only stay for 3 months, what is the loss? You can always look for another place. Now, people are seeing how genuine our movement is. They are coming forward to offer us so many places. We simply have to maintain our strict principles, keeping ourselves pure. Otherwise, there are so many bogus institutions who are doing business in the name of God and simply cheating people. So we have to be careful not to degenerate like these others. Our strength depends upon regularly chanting the required 16 rounds and rigidly adhering to the regulated principles. So that was the basis, you know, for making progress. Not whether you do some business deal and get a big property and make some business showing the deity, etc., which is what happens in a lot of places. You know, people think that because they've got some temple and they can show the deities and people come and put some money in the hundi, you know, oh, that's our success. We've made so much money today by showing the deities. That mentality, Prabhupada said, is there in many of the temples in Vrindavan. They have no program for educating the people in spiritual life. They don't go out and preach. They think simply by, you know, sitting still and attracting, the deity attracts, and then we get some money and we share that, divide it up, and live very nicely. That is not Lord Chaitanya's movement. And Prabhupada was, you know, not at all keen on ISKCON becoming another edition of such organizations. Okay, so a few other japa pastimes. This will kind of bring this japa section to an end. Yes, Mahatma Prabhu.
Can I ask you, how many members did you see for that Fiji temple?
How many trustee members were there in Fiji?
Yes.
I have no idea. That kind of technical detail, it would depend on, you know, local conditions, what, you know, the legal requirements are. I mean, generally speaking, around the world, any kinds of trusts, they usually have between 5 and 7, or, you know, 7 and 9 trustee members, but it could be more. It would depend a lot on local legal requirements. But the point from our point of view was that a majority of the trustees, if you were receiving a property from people that were not devotees, then Prabhupada would make it so that the trust had a majority of ISKCON devotees who were initiated. And in fact, one of Prabhupada's principles was that nobody could be a trustee, at least for ISKCON's purposes, unless they're an actual initiated devotee. I mean, in that circumstance in Fiji, Dayoji and his brother were not initiated at the point where they formed the trust. But when Prabhupada went there in April, he initiated them. Yeah. So the general principle is that the majority of the trustees should be initiated disciples following the principles. Then that will enable you to retain, you know, the proper standards. We had problems in Hyderabad where one family gave us a huge piece of land, about 560 acres, and some trust was set up with the family members and also ISKCON members. We had a slight majority, but later on there was a falling out, and then after a lot of legal entanglement, they were able to take their property back, and we were left with a very small portion of it. So these things have to be done very carefully, and you have to secure ISKCON's interests, you know, as a controlling entity. That's the main principle. Okay, so a couple of little miscellaneous Japa pastimes. In 1976, in June, Prabhupada went to, he spent the first 11 days in Los Angeles. Then we flew up to Detroit. And, of course, we just got that fabulous property, the Fisher Mansion. Lawrence Fisher was a car magnate from the 1920s. His factory used to construct most of the car bodies, you know, but that was when Detroit was, you know, just coming into its ascendancy as Motown or the Motor Town. And Lawrence Fisher, you know, was fabulously wealthy, and he decided he bought a property on the side of a canal. That canal led directly into the Great Lakes, so he built like a mini Versailles on that property. It was, you know, in 1927 or 29, I think it was built. He spent $3 million on it at that time. So, you know, you could say it's the equivalent of spending like about $100 million on a house nowadays. You know, then his friends gradually bought properties next to him. So all down the canal side, there were all these big, huge, fabulous mansions. But the Fisher Mansion was the best one of all. He'd imported artisans from all over Europe, you know, to do sculpting and wrought iron work and marble work and so many different things. He had 4 acres of land, and he had it built so that he could just go downstairs, get on his boat, and then sail out from under the house directly onto the canal, you know, sail back in again. He had a little bowling alley. He had a ballroom. It was about as big as this temple. The ballroom was fabulous. It was designed to look like a Venetian street at night time. So the ceiling was painted, you know, with clouds and sky. And, on going down each wall, there were like little bay windows poking out. So it looked like you were on the street, looking up at the houses, and he would have these, balls there. And there was an end section just like this with 3 archways, yeah, and the orchestra used to sit there and they would play the music and they would have a good time. And he had a huge swimming pool at the side of the house, which was completely encased in a glass house, and there was an underground heated tunnel to go from the main house, you know, to the swimming pool. So even in the middle of winter in Detroit, when it was like minus 20 or something, they could go and enjoy swimming and things like that. So it was an amazing place. Later on, you know, it became disused. The whole area became a ghetto. Black families were moving in, poor families, and the whole place became a ghetto. So all the rich people started moving out, and they moved to Grosse Pointe instead. So gradually all these mansions fell into disrepair, and the Fisher Mansion was still maintained. The other ones, you know, some of them were taken over by squatters. Some bikie gang had moved into one of them and just literally destroyed it from the inside out. And this one property was kind of left there standing, and it was up for sale. But nobody would buy it because of the area. So the devotees saw it in 1975. Prabhupada had gone there, and so he went to see it himself. And then he sat down. He told us afterwards, he said, as soon as I saw it, I thought this would be a wonderful temple for Krishna. So he sat down with a real estate agent, and then he immediately started preaching to him that actually Lord Chaitanya's movement is the prime benediction. It is the greatest humanitarian work all over the world. So why don't you give us this building? So, because the man said, I can't give you it. It's not mine to give. But so Prabhupada said, all right. He said, we'll give you $300,000 cash. That's it. And Prabhupada said when he made that offer, he had actually didn't even have a dollar. He had no idea where the money was going to come from, but he just wanted the building, so he offered him $300,000. So the agent accepted it because he knew he was not going to find anybody to buy it. Such a huge property, and in such a, you know, poor area. So Prabhupada told the devotees, it doesn't matter about the area, we can live anywhere. And he said, eventually it will improve anyway. So they sealed the deal. Prabhupada personally sealed the deal. Ambarish Prabhu gave half the money. Lekha Shrivanti, who was the daughter of Walter Ruther, who had been the biggest of the union leaders in the 1950s, she had got an inheritance, and then she became a devotee. So she gave the other half. So they bought the property. So in 1976, it was Prabhupada's first visit there, you know, with us as the owners. So we arrived on the 11th, and they'd given Prabhupada one very nice room. It was, had a kind of an arched ceiling. It was like a Spanish hacienda style, you know, stucco walls, and, you know, very decorative. It was, you know, a beautiful place. Very big bathroom. You know, the shower had six nozzles, three on the, up each side, one from the top. Because Prabhupada still bathed from a brass bucket. He never used the shower. But it was an amazing place. And, you know, we'd been taken on a tour of it the next morning. And every room was just fabulous, you know. The room that we were staying in next to Prabhupada's, the bathroom, was done out with black tiles and gold leaf. So, you know, the taps were gold leaf, the toilet handle was gold leaf, the toilet roll holder was gold leaf, the entire ceiling was gold leaf. That was the bathroom. Yeah. So, as, you know, Prabhupada was looking around, he said, we paid $300,000 for the whole building. He said, just one room is worth $300,000. So he's very pleased with it. So we settled in. And as I was unpacking, Prabhupada was, you know, decided to chant a few rounds. So the devotees, having seen in India that, you know, many places you go, they have these duris or cotton mattresses, thin cotton mattresses, and they cover them with clean white linen sheets. That way then, you know, when they get dirty, it's easy to remove the sheets, wash them, and replace them. So they got this idea, although there was a very, you know, thick carpet, very expensive carpet on the floor, they thought, we'll cover the floor with clean white sheets, make it look like India. So they laid down, you know, these strips of cloth, linen, they didn't, you know, they weren't stitched together, so they didn't entirely cover the carpet, so they had to put two or three strips down. But the edges, of course, were loose, so thinking that maybe somebody might trip over them, so somebody had pinned them together. So, you know, as I was unpacking, I was putting Prabhupada's stuff on his desk, you know, his dictaphone and other things, his books. Prabhupada was walking up and down chanting japa. Then all of a sudden he stopped. And he looked down and he said, what is this? And I looked down and he was standing on a pin. So they put these pins in and all the pins were sticking up. And Prabhupada was walking along and trodden on the pin. Fortunately, it didn't go, you know, into his foot. But Prabhupada just shook his head. He said, they have no common sense. So I had to pull all the pins out. Yeah. So that was one little japa pastime. Another interesting japa pastime was in Bhubaneswar in 1977. We had gone there. Prabhupada was going to lay the foundation stone for the new temple there. Gaur-Govinda Maharaj had been living in Bhubaneswar for some months, maybe a year or so, because he was from Orissa. When he joined, very quickly he was given sannyas and he was preaching down in Hyderabad. But then the chief minister or the ex-chief minister had given us some land just on the outskirts at that time of Bhubaneswar. Bhubaneswar is part of Jagannath Puri now. And it's the capital of Orissa. So, you know, the government offices and things are there. So when we got there, we had been to the Kumbh Mela in Allahabad. Then we went by train overnight to Calcutta. And then from Calcutta we went down to Bhubaneswar. So when we arrived there, you know, we saw it's just a desert. There was nothing there. There was just this barren, you know, red earth and no buildings. Gogobinda Maharaja got this, you know, fairly small plot of land. And he had a crude fence around it made from twigs, you know, like thorn twigs. Because he had no money, so he couldn't afford to put a proper fence up. He'd built one small brick cottage with a thatched roof. And then there was another small brick cottage where he had some deities. And that was the whole thing. So it wasn't looking very hopeful. And as soon as we got there, of course, naturally all of us were thinking, why are we here? You know, we're just an hour from Jagannath Puri. Why don't we get something there? You know, Puri is the main place. Only Srila Prabhupada and Gogobinda Maharaj were optimistic. You know, but the other sannyasis, you know, Gagamuni was there, Satsarup was there, I think Bhavananda came down. And so, you know, after a couple of days, there was some discussion about getting someplace in Jagannath Puri. And Prabhupada had said that he was never going to return to Jagannath Puri unless his disciples were allowed in the temple there. But when the idea came up of getting our own land and building our own temple, then he said, all right, so we can look into that. So Gagamuni had gone there and identified a few properties. And then on January 25th morning, we had driven to Jagannath Puri to see these properties. The idea was that we would return in the afternoon. But what happened was, because we spent the day, Gagamuni rented a couple of rooms in a place called the Tourist Bungalow Number 1, which was right on the seashore. And so whilst we were there, I guess the word had got out, or some of our devotees that had some contacts in Jagannath Puri, the word got out to this gentleman. His name was Sadashiva Rutt, and he was one of the main pujaris at the main Jagannath temple. So in the afternoon he came to see Srila Prabhupada and invited him to attend a program that he was holding the next day, which was the inauguration of some book, some commentary on the Bhagavatam that had been translated into Arian. And he thought, you know, Bhaktivedanta Swami's here, he's got his foreign disciples, that will attract a lot of attention. If I can get him to come to the book inauguration, you know, a lot of people will come. So he was a nice man, actually. He was friendly. And Prabhupada liked him. When he came in the afternoon, on the next day then. So what happened was we stayed overnight. I had to go back to Bhubaneswar and collect Prabhupada's fresh clothing and toiletries and stuff. And so we stayed overnight. The next morning we had a very wonderful pastime where Prabhupada went down to the seashore after his massage and bathed in the sea. And Guru Kripa was there with all of his Namhata men, and Jaidharma was there from Sydney visiting, and Satsarup, Bhagavat Das was there, and a few others. And when Prabhupada was standing on the seashore with the waves, you know, coming, washing in up around his knees, we started bathing him with the seawater. So we were scooping up water and putting it on his head and rubbing off the oil from the massage. Prabhupada loved it. It was like a transcendental abhishek. And actually, Guru Kripa and his men, they were into chanting slokas, so they all chanted the Brahma Samhita prayers while we were doing it. So it was a really wonderful pastime. It was one of the, you know, one of the most memorable that I had when I was with Prabhupada. So then in the afternoon, then on the 26th of January, just before we set off to the site where, you know, Sadashiva Rat had set up this small pandal for his book inauguration, he came to see Prabhupada in the afternoon at the hotel. And Prabhupada asked him to chant the Jagannath Ashtakam, so he knew them all off by heart, of course, and he chanted them very wonderfully. Prabhupada told me to record it. That recording must still be there somewhere. I've never come across it again since then, but it must still be in the archives somewhere. So then afterwards Prabhupada told us that we should all learn how to chant those prayers to Lord Jagannath. So I don't know whether you guys do that when you have Rathiatra, you've got Lord Jagannath here. In LA, I know, for the week leading up to Rathiatra, every morning they chant the Jagannath Ashtakam, you know, as a build-up to the Rathiatra. It's very nice. Anyway, so we did that program. It was quite amusing. There was a small stage with a little shamayana on the top. There were a few pandas and pujaris from the Jagannath temple there. And then when we arrived, immediately Prabhupada was invited. The stage was quite low. It was, you know, like 2 or 3 feet high. So all the devotees, we all sat down in front of the stage. Prabhupada went up onto the stage. And immediately then Sadashiva Rat asked Srila Prabhupada to speak. So when Prabhupada started speaking, and they gave him a copy of the book, and he was supposed to say something about the book. Prabhupada put the book down and then gave, you know, this half-hour lecture about why they should allow the foreign devotees to come into the Jagannath Puri temple. And he's speaking very strongly, and he was making the point that, you know, the Lord is not Purinath, he's not Ariyanath, but he's Jagannath. So if the devotees from the Jagat want to come and see him, then why should you stop them? So as he was speaking, one or two of the people behind him got offended, and they got up and walked off. But Prabhupada, you know, absolutely didn't care. He just said what he wanted to say. And then at the end of it, he stopped, and I was sitting in front, and he looked at me, he said, "So, you know, I mean, shall we go?" So I shrugged, "Yeah, I guess." And then, Sadashiva Rat, he said, the book. You haven't mentioned the book. You have to inaugurate the book. So Prabhupada took the book. He said, they say this is the Bhagavat of such and such a person. So today it is inaugurated. That was it. He put it down. So that was it. We left. On the way back to Bhubaneswar, we stopped off at 2 Gaudiya Math temples, and then also we stopped off at Shakshi Gopal. That's the town of village of Shakshi Gopal is where the deity of Shakshi Gopal is. So we, as we were going through, we were talking, "Oh, this is the famous Shakshi Gopal, you know, the one that walked from Vrindavan to Vijayanagar." So Prabhupada agreed, said, "All right, do you want to see him?" So we were all fired up. Yeah, so we actually went to see Shakshi Gopal. We got right inside the deity room, a couple of us, with Srila Prabhupada. I was like about a foot away from him. It's a very big deity. It's about 6 feet tall. But the behavior of the pujaris there was appalling. We had a very bad experience. Yes, just simply money. That's another story, anyway. To get to the point about the japa pastimes. So Prabhupada had invited Sadashiva Rat that we're having our foundation stone ceremony and a program at our temple in Bhubaneswar on February the 2nd, which was Nityananda Prabhu's appearance day. So please come and, you know, you can speak there. So he agreed. So this was on February the 2nd then, Nityananda's appearance day. Early in the evening, Prabhupada came to the pandal. So we did the foundation stone ceremony in the morning, and then in the evening we were having a pandal. So this time, instead of speaking himself, he asked Sadashiva Rat to deliver a lecture. So he went on and on and on for about 3/4 of an hour, and he was speaking in Aryan, so we couldn't understand what he was saying anyway. And then finally he finished and we had a kirtan. So towards the end of his lecture, which was in Aryan, Guru Kripa and his men, who were sitting on the stage behind him, were becoming agitated. So they were getting very restless. It's going on and on and on. It wasn't showing any signs of stopping. So Guru Kripa took out his beads and he started chanting. But he did it very loudly. So he took them out. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. And as he did it, he gave a sidelong glance at Srila Prabhupada, who was sitting at the side on his Vyasa set. And he was doing it very loudly. And he looked over to see if Srila Prabhupada was going to say anything. And Prabhupada just kept looking straight ahead. He could hear it, but he didn't say anything. He just kept looking straight ahead. So then Guru Kripa's men, they all took out their beads and they started chanting japa, but really loudly. So they're all sitting behind Sadashiva Rat. He's trying to speak and they're all, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare, like this. So after a few minutes, then he took the hint and then he wound up his lecture. He stopped talking and then that was it. Then Prabhupada got off the Vyasa sound and we went back into his rooms. So then as soon as he got settled in, Guru Kripa came into his room. He had a kind of a mischievous grin on his face. And so he sat, when he sat down, he said, Prabhupada, he said, was that the etiquette? He knew very well it wasn't, but because Prabhupada hadn't said anything, you know, so he said, was that the etiquette? So Prabhupada smiled. He said, well, he said, it's better to let them speak. He said, after all, he is a learned scholar. But he spoke so many things, but there was no conclusion. He's a householder after all. So by that, Prabhupada indicated that these men are professional speakers and they use their learning and ability to speak at various meetings to earn a living to support their families. But actually, they have no real idea what the actual conclusion of Shastra is. So they know lots of things, they tell stories, they quote slokas, and they just go on and on and on, but they never come to any actual point, yeah, because they're earning, that's how they earn their living. So anyway, that was another little japa pastime there. So just to round up, it's getting late for me, but the question may come then, with so much emphasis on chanting japa, is there any time when, you know, it's acceptable to not chant japa? That question may come up. So, of course, we have the story of Haridas Thakur, just at the very end of his pastimes. Then Lord Chaitanya went to see him, and he asked him, I heard you have some disease. What is that disease? And he said, my disease is I cannot finish my rounds. Yeah. So even he, the Namacharya, at the very end, because of old age and debilitation, he was, you know, struggling to finish his rounds, 192 rounds. And then, of course, he left his body holding onto the lotus feet of Lord Chaitanya. So when you get very old like that, then so many adjustments have to be made. You know, you can follow a very strict standards of sadhana, as long as you're fit and healthy. But if you get diseased, then some concession is allowed. So similarly with Srila Prabhupada, when just in the last few months, of course, he wasn't eating, he got so weak and his body got so debilitated he couldn't even roll over in the bed by himself. He had no strength left. So under those conditions, he also stopped chanting his rounds. Up until that, illness, of course, he was always chanting every day, chanted his 16 rounds. But in that last few months, he was not able to do that. So I remember also he had received a letter in 1976 when we were in Vrindavan from one of his godbrothers. And his godbrother had reported a similar thing, that he was so ill that he was no longer able to take a bath every day. And he was having so many problems. So when Prabhupada read that, he shook his head, you know. He said, just see, this material body is so troublesome. And then, of course, he was in the same position. And he told us, do not think this will not happen to you. So that time is coming for everybody. Yeah. You think because you're young that you're going to live forever, but you're not. Yeah. So there were other instances. When Hansadibs told me that when they first went to India, Prabhupada arrived on August 28th, 1970, from Japan with four sannyasis, and that was when ISKCON really started its preaching in India. It became a sensation. They had the first pandals at Deshapriya Park in Calcutta, and about 20 to 30,000 people a night were coming just to see the foreign devotees. Then they moved over to Bombay. They had huge pandals across Maidan. They got invited to Surat and Gorakhpur. And in fact, Prabhupada was receiving invitations, you know, for four or five programs a day. So they were rushing from one place to another. And Hansadutta was one of the first batch of devotees in that first batch. So they were also running here and there, trying to make arrangements. And so he couldn't find the time to chant his rounds. And he went to, after a couple of months, he went to see Srila Prabhupada. And he said, Prabhupada, he said, we're so busy that I can't get my round. I'm not getting my rounds done. And Prabhupada said, that's all right. This is an emergency. So he wanted to take advantage as much as possible, you know, of the, you know, kind of sensation of, you know, these foreign Vaishnavas coming into India. So he was capitalizing on that as much as possible. So because they were fully engaged day and night, therefore he didn't, you know, enforce that as strongly. Also in London, Shyamasunda, you know, he and Malati and the other two householder couples, they had started the temple there in London. Then eventually when, you know, they had to move out of John Lennon's estate, they found this place at Bury Place in London. So Shyamasunda was a bit of a carpenter and a handyman. He was also the GBC. So he was working very hard trying to get the place ready for the temple opening and the installation of Radha Lundanishwara. So he also wasn't chanting his rounds. Some of the devotees went to Srila Prabhupada and said, you know, Shyamasunda's not chanting his rounds. And Prabhupada gave more or less the same answer. He said, that's all right, he's working hard. He said, Arjuna was also not chanting because he was fighting a war. So, you know, he excused him from that. Also, Gargamuni Swami, for other reasons. Actually, Gargamuni was never able to chant 16 rounds right from the very beginning. Maybe occasionally. But he always struggled with his rounds. But, you know, he was a hard worker. He was very intelligent. He was a very good organizer. And he was exceptionally good at making money. Sometimes Prabhupada would call him Gargamuni. Yeah. Because Garga means a pot. Yeah, so he said Garga means pot and Muni means money. So he sometimes struggled. So he was only doing a few rounds every day. That became an issue at one point. And there is a letter which I don't have right now where he had written to Prabhupada, and Prabhupada actually told him, that's all right, then you can just chant 8 rounds a day. So generally that was his practice. In 1976, Gargamuni had spent 75 back in America. He had been the temple president in Calcutta for a couple of years and done very well there. Then he went back to the West to, you know, raise some funds, and they bought 5 or 6 Mercedes vans in Germany, which they drove over to India. And he started up the library party in India. So they had these vans and they were traveling all over. But some of his men became a little disturbed because of his personal sadhana, which was not very strong, and particularly he wasn't chanting his rounds. So when the GBC arrived at the Mayapur Festival in 76, of course they had their meetings, and there was some discussion there about adding new GBCs. And on March the 8th, in 1976, then in the early morning, Prabhupada called in Tamal Krishna Goswami to his room. Tamal Krishna had been made the chairman of the GBC for that year. I think it was the first year that the GBC started having that system on Prabhupada's request, that they have an official chairman, vice chairman, and secretary. So Prabhupada told Tamal Krishna that Madhavisa Swami should be made the GBC vice chairman for the year, and he also said that Gagamuni Swami should be given GBC responsibility. Tamal Krishna replied that GBC had already considered Gagamuni, but they decided not to appoint him because he does not regularly chant his rounds. Some of his men have left him, complaining that his devotional standard is not strict. Prabhupada said that despite this, he should still be made a GBC member, the reason being that Gagamuni has what he called creative energy that should be used constructively. Otherwise, he said, he may become frustrated and misapply it. So, you know, he was a passionate guy, very intelligent, and Prabhupada thought, now if he's not kept amongst the leaders making decisions, then he'll cause trouble for whoever is his GBC. So better to make him a GBC, and he'll channel that energy in a constructive way. Okay, one final example, and then we're going to finish. In Orissa, when we were in Bhubaneswar, Bhagavat Das was there helping Gaur Govinda Maharaj. And Gaur Govinda Maharaj had asked Prabhupada to tell Bhagavat, you know, to remain there as his, you know, to assist him. And Bhagavat, of course, he had different ideas. As I mentioned, the Bhubaneswar temple was actually just a little brick cottage with a straw thatched roof. So he wasn't too particularly enthusiastic about staying there. Now, a few months before, actually just at the end of 1975, Bhagavat had approached Prabhupada in Delhi and asked to be given sannyas. So Prabhupada was a little reluctant, and so he wouldn't commit himself to it. After Bhagavat went out, he said, because Bhagavat was a very, you know, he's tall, but he was also very big. His girth was very huge. And so Prabhupada had commented that to take sannyas, one should be fit, not fat. You know, he didn't immediately agree. So in 1977, we were in Bhubaneswar. Bhagavat was there. He was working really hard. So on February the 2nd, Prabhupada held the cornerstone laying ceremony. This is from the Leelamrita. About 1,000 people came during the day to take prasadam. Sadashiva Rat attended and spoke. Prabhupada's disciples, Swarup Damodar, also spoke, and so did Srila Prabhupada. Later, Prabhupada discussed with his disciples how to manage the Bhubaneswar center. Some of the sannyasis admitted to Prabhupada that they didn't see much potential there. But Prabhupada questioned, why not? This is the capital of Orissa. People are coming here, and we have to have centers in every town. Even if it's not a big center, somehow or another, we have to work and stay here. Even if the people are coming every night only to eat khichdi, that is still preaching. One of the devotees said that it was too far from town, our center, and that Orissa was too poor. A better idea might be to try and build a big temple in Jagannath Puri. Prabhupada replied that to build in Jagannath Puri was all right, but Bhubaneswar was also important. Prabhupada's Aryan disciple, Gaur Govinda Maharaj, told Prabhupada that as soon as the annual Indian pilgrimage was over, you know, for the Westerners, all the devotees would leave and he would again be left alone with only one or two brahmacharis. He was particularly suited to translating, and so he asked Prabhupada to give him somebody to help manage the center. Where is the fat one? Prabhupada asked. Bring him here. A devotee ran out to fetch Bhagavat. At the time the devotee found him, Bhagavat was sitting in the visitor's tent, because all the devotees that were visiting, they had to live in tents. There was no other place for them. So he was telling the other devotees about his plan to go to New York. When he heard that Prabhupada wanted to see him, he assumed it was in connection with the cornerstone laying ceremony, since he was in charge. But as soon as he entered Prabhupada's room, he sensed something heavy was about to happen. Prabhupada smiled and asked Bhagavat how he was. I'm fine, Srila Prabhupada. So, how would you like to stay here and manage this place? Well, Prabhupada, I don't really think that I can stay here. It's too hard. You can't stay here and build this building? Well, I could, but it's very difficult, and I was all set to go to New York. Bhagwat began excitedly telling Prabhupada about a telegram he had received from the New York temple president, Adikeshava Swami, inviting him to come and head up an important preaching department in the temple. New York, Prabhupada said, they have too many men in New York already. Why don't you don't have to go to New York, you should stay here. Bhagwat objected. He said he couldn't work with Gagamuni Swami, the GBC men for this area of India. Prabhupada replied that he was sending Gagamuni to Bangladesh, and so he wouldn't be in charge of ISKCON in Orissa anymore. And he said that I will personally supervise you. So Bhagwat's next objection was that his health was not good, and he had to sleep a lot. This is a very healthy place, Prabhupada countered. You simply go out into the field to pass stool, wash with your lota, and afterwards clean the lota with the mud. And you can bathe with the same lota. So in this way you can stay clean and healthy. So then Bhagwat raised his ultimate objection. So he was, you know, one after another, Prabhupada was shooting them all down. He said, Srila Prabhupada, to tell you the truth, I'm not chanting my rounds. I think I'd better go back to New York because there's good association there and I can become strong in my regulations. That's all right, Prabhupada replied. You were working very hard. So if sometimes you aren't chanting your rounds, that's all right. As long as you were working hard, then you can do your rounds another time. Well, Prabhupada, Bhagwat said, according to the Govashtakam, I can understand that whenever you please the spiritual master, you please Krishna. So Prabhupada smiled. He said, yes. So if you want me to stay here, then I should stay. So Prabhupada said, yes, I want you to stay here and make life members and build this building and help manage the place. So although Prabhupada had laid a cornerstone for the temple, the center had no funds or donors in sight and no established congregation. All the devotees had was their faith in Srila Prabhupada. So that was it. Bhagwat stayed. So under that circumstance, again, we shouldn't take it that if I'm working hard, I don't need to chant my rounds. Prabhupada didn't have anybody to manage the center in Bhubaneswar. He knew it was going to be an important place. And so he therefore personally excused Bhagwat from having to chant his rounds as long as he was working hard. We shouldn't take that as a precedent, you know, for ourselves. Okay, there are a couple of other examples, but it's 10 to 9. I really have to finish because we have to go into the city, right? You've got a vehicle and everything. Okay. Okay, so thank you all very much. What's happening this evening? Anything? Am I speaking this evening or not? I like, but you tell me. I'm here, I'm your servant. I'm not, you know, dictating what the program is. You have to tell me what you want me to do. Is there some other program or not? Dev and Rita Maharaj is coming back or something? Or?
He's going to be giving Bhagavatam class tomorrow morning.
Okay, so what's happening this evening? Well, I'll speak this evening if there's no other program. No, you say, what time do you normally have your evening programs?
Seven thirty to 8:30.
Yeah. Okay, so then 7:30 after the arati. We'll continue on. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.